It's the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour on 810 WGY.
Good evening. You're listening to the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King here tonight, substituting for Greg. Our show is here each Sunday at 9 p.m., and we're here to give you our insights into the legal and political issues happening locally and across the country that affect you. In addition to listening on your radio, we're broadcasting around the world on WGY.com. Visit our show site at TullyRinkyShow.com for podcasts of previous shows. So joining me as co-host tonight is criminal defense attorney at Tully Ringy, Tom Carr. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Barbara. Good to be here.
And tonight we'll be looking at the issue of domestic violence and the resources available for domestic violence victims. Our guest for tonight is Executive Director of the Legal Project, Lisa Frisch. Lisa leads this worthy nonprofit, which extends a variety of pro bono legal services to individuals in the Capital Region. And now, with the addition of my own family law background, we're going to provide and discuss a perspective on domestic violence tonight, including the Legal Project itself and the resources they offer, just what is domestic violence and the patterns to watch for, as well as common misconceptions, and how the Legal Project works in both family and criminal courts. If you have any questions for us throughout the show, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or simply press star WGY on your cell phone. Now, I'd like to take a moment to introduce Lisa Frisch. Lisa is the executive director of the Legal Project of the Capital District Women's Bar Association. The Legal Project is a not-for-profit organization which provides pro bono and low-cost legal services addressing the civil legal needs of the working poor, with a special representation program for domestic violence survivors. Previously, she was the Director of Research and Criminal Justice for the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence, where she directed the development of statewide policies, programs, and evaluation of the civil and criminal justice system's response to violence against women. So, good evening, Lisa.
Hi, Barbara. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
And first, I'd like you to tell us briefly, what is the Legal Project?
Well, as you said, we're a nonprofit program. We've been around for 13 years, and we provide free and low-cost civil legal assistance to the working poor in the Capital Region, and that's Albany, Rensselaer, Schenectady, and Saratoga counties primarily.
What kind of services do you provide?
Well, we started out originally focusing on domestic violence, but that has expanded to a number of different programs. We provide what we call our legal clinic program, where anyone in the Capital Region can call us with a civil legal question, and we can connect them with an attorney for a private one-on-one consultation about that issue.
At no cost?
At no cost. And we hold those in the evenings in a variety of different places around the Capital Region, like the Albany Public Library and Equinox and Unity House in Troy.
In addition to this legal advice, do you also actually give people representation?
We do in several different areas. In addition to the domestic violence program, we have pro bono or volunteer attorneys who work with us as well as our staff attorneys. But the volunteer attorneys do work such as affordable housing. So first-time low-income home buyers can get free representation from one of these volunteer attorneys to buy their first home.
Who are these volunteer attorneys?
Well, it's a variety of different people. It's really anyone who's an attorney in the Capital Region can volunteer with us. Because we have so many different programs, like the housing program, the clinic program, we also have a bankruptcy program, which is a program with representation that also can appeal to attorneys with a variety of background. We also have a small business program, so business attorneys who might not otherwise think about volunteering for pro bono can do so in that small business program, so we're able to provide information and assistance to people who are trying to start or expand a small business. We also have a wills and estates program for low-income people with HIV and AIDS, which we work with the Legal Aid Society on. So we have a lot of different programs, including a legally speaking program where attorneys can go and do a speaking engagement for a community group or an organization on any legal topic.
Like senior citizens,
yes,
or classrooms?
Absolutely. So on anything, on any civil legal issue, we have attorneys who can provide that assistance. So really any attorney who's willing to give back some of their time, can volunteer with us either for a short term, a couple of hours a month or once in a while thing, or on a regular basis. So we have 200 attorneys who volunteer with us across
the country. That was actually my next question. Yeah. We know lawyers sometimes get a bad rap. Yeah. Do you have a significant number of lawyers who volunteer?
We do. I mean, 200 is a very large number. 75 of those volunteers specifically for the domestic violence program, as you do, Barbara. You're one of our wonderful pro bono attorneys. So we have attorneys who specialize in matrimonial law, family law, who are willing, again, to give back to represent a victim of domestic violence who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford an attorney.
Now, you made a comment that was interesting. You said you represent the working poor. What does that mean?
Well, people who are not living necessarily at poverty level, but who are living check to check and just cannot afford legal help. And really the point of a program like the Legal Project is to ensure that everyone has the right to civil legal help. I mean, we know in our criminal law system you have a right to an attorney. In civil law, it's less so. So it's very, very difficult for people to have an even playing field in terms of justice if they don't have the money to hire an attorney.
Thank you. I'm also interested in some new programs that you told me you're developing. Specifically, you mentioned a military program. As you know, our firm does quite a bit of military representation. Mm-hmm. What is this program geared toward?
Well, it's a brand new program. It hasn't even officially started. We're actually looking to hire someone for this position. But we will be we were given a federal appropriation to do this. It's one of the only programs like this in the country, and we will be able to provide civil legal assistance in family court or in matrimonial cases to victims of domestic violence who are either in the military or are partnered with someone in the military or National Guard. And we're able to coordinate with the military in terms of the specialized military law issues, making sure they're able to get orders of protection and so on in the community as well. And to ensure that their rights are protected. We know that there's a real rise in domestic violence and homicide-suicide and all sorts of really unfortunate things that are happening with people coming home from the Middle East right now.
This is a trend you're seeing?
It's a major trend, and it's something we actually applied for this grant almost 2 years ago because we saw it coming, and it's absolutely happening as people are coming home.
That's interesting. You also mentioned previously that there were some Spanish-speaking programs and immigration programs. Mm-hmm. It seems like the Legal Project is really expanding based on the needs that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about those new programs.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we try to do, is expand, not just to expand, but when we see a community need that's not met elsewhere, we try to fill that gap. And one of the things that we really see, particularly in the area of domestic violence, but in general, is the ability to provide outreach to the Hispanic community in the capital region, and also to reach out to the immigrant community. So we have a new program that we're starting up now where we will have someone on staff who is Spanish-speaking who will be able to go out to those communities and let them know about what help is available.
Now, how does the Legal Project support itself? How can people help?
Well, as you said, we're a nonprofit, so we depend a lot on the community and the generosity of individuals as well as foundations and corporations to assist us. We also get some government funding, which right now is in question with the state budget. We also get lots of grants from a variety of different areas, both government and non-government. So it's a patchwork that we have to make sure that we're able to maintain in order to maintain the programs, which are really critical for people in the community. So we are always looking for help. We have a donation button right on our website.
And what is that website?
It's www.legalproject.org. So anything. We were on the radio one time talking, and a woman drove up and handed us $10 when she heard what we did. And that $10 was put to good use. So it's not that we needed a gazillion dollars from everybody. Just anything makes a big difference.
And other than the attorneys that volunteer, do you use other volunteers?
We do. We have volunteers to coordinate the legal clinics that we have offsite. And also, we also have law students and other volunteers in the office.
And how much of the work that the Legal Project does is domestic violence-centered?
I'd say a little over half. And right now, it looks like we'll probably have about 800 victims that we serve this year, which is our largest number so far. And overall, we assist about 1,500 people a year.
All right. Well, we'd like to hear from you tonight. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or *WGY on your cell phones. And if you have questions but can't join us tonight, don't forget that we can be reached all week at the Tully Rinke office at 518-218-7100. When we're back, we'll go over some of the common misconceptions associated with domestic abuse and hear a little bit from Tom Carr on his perspective.
You've worked hard to acquire your wealth. Let us help you keep it. Hi, I'm Abigail Doolittle, Portfolio Manager at Johnson Illington Advisors. Johnson Illington is a money management firm that provides very conservative and disciplined portfolio management services. Our main goal at Johnson Illington is to preserve and enhance your wealth. We have a highly experienced team led by nationally known investment veteran and economist Hugh Johnson. Visit our website at johnson-illington.com. Johnson Illington Advisors on Broadway in Albany.
All right, Integral One Network Solutions. Tell me what they do again.
Well, they worked with us to design our new computer network. That's really made a difference. Helps us run our business better. They monitor everything 24/7 to keep it running smoothly. And they manage it all, so I don't have to hire an IT guy.
So when I hire Integral One, they manage my network so I can manage my business. Talk about peace of mind.
Integral One Network Solutions, online at integralone.net. That's integralone.net, 464-4014.
Usually, a mortgage company's sole focus is property, but first-rate funding is centered on people, not property. Whether you're buying a home or struggling with your current adjustable-rate mortgage, first-rate funding will give you the same amazing personal service. First-rate funding, New Carter Road, Albany, and Broadway, Saratoga Springs. Don't wait. Call today, 452-4700, and please go online, firstratefunding.net, and see how they can help you today. Registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department. Mortgage loans arranged with third-party providers.
As a busy working professional, looking good's important to you. No one understands this better than Best Cleaners, the Capital Region's premier garment care provider and dry cleaner. Got a wrinkle in your schedule? Best Cleaners offers pickup and delivery of your dry cleaning right from your home or office, so you don't have to fit one more errand into your busy week. Call 458-BEST, and we'll take care of the rest. With three locations in Del Mar, Loudonville, and on the Latham Circle, Best Cleaners. Always look your best. Call 458-BEST. 458-BEST.
I've got the power! Welcome back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King, and tonight I'm joined by criminal defense attorney at Tully Rinke, Tom Carr. Our special guest tonight is Executive Director of the Legal Project, Lisa Frisch. And tonight we're talking about the pro bono legal services available to victims of domestic violence. If you hear something you want to give your opinion on, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY and feel free to check us out online anytime at tullylegal.com. We had just begun discussing the domestic violence work done by the Legal Project, and we have with us tonight criminal defense attorney Tom Carr. Tom was assistant district attorney in Brooklyn, working in the Domestic Violence Bureau. He has been an assistant district attorney in Rensselaer County, in the Bureau Chief Special Victims Bureau, and he is now a defense attorney representing defendants charged with domestic violence. Tom, I want to ask you a little bit about your experience as somebody prosecuting domestic violence. How basically is it defined?
Well, Barb, domestic violence is defined really as a situation when a family member, partner, ex-partner attempts to physically or psychologically dominate another, specifically their partner. Now, it includes cohabitants, people who are living together but are not married, or non-married, non-living together intimate partners.
Well, how does somebody identify domestic violence? I've heard a variety of different definitions. Does it necessarily have to be physical? I've heard it involves things such as control of a non-physical nature.
That's basically what's at the heart of it, is the issue of control. Most often in court, we see it when it has actually risen to a physical level, where there has been an actual assault on somebody else. The police are called, a case is generated from that, and it winds up in the courts. But the abuse, for want of a better word, pre-physical abuse, usually starts a lot earlier. And it's a building up to the point of where the abuse becomes physical.
So Lisa, in your experience, I think Tom hit the nail on the head, as I understand it. It's not something that just happens out of the blue. It's a course of conduct. What types of things are you seeing with the people that come into your office?
Well, it's a variety of different things, and a lot of times a victim of domestic violence is not going to easily identify herself as a victim, because a lot of what has gone on that is abusive in that relationship is going to be hard to identify, like controlling the economics, controlling the finances of the family is something that's very, very common in domestic violence. Emotional abuse, that extreme jealousy, using threats that they're going to take the children or they're going to harm a friend or family member who might be helping them. Often it's isolating the person from their friends and family, just breaking down the relationships, any other support system that victim might have.
Preventing someone from spending time with their family.
Right. That's very, very common.
You use the pronoun her. Just to be clear, we're talking about domestic violence that really isn't gender specific.
Well, I don't use gender neutral language when I talk about domestic violence, because the vast majority of victims of domestic violence are women who are abused by their male partners. We know that it also happens where men are abused. Men can also be abused, and women can be abused by same gender partners. But primarily, when you look at domestic violence, when you look at the level of injury that happens, when you look at fear and control in relationships, it's really primarily a problem of women who are victimized. Which is why even the federal government has a Violence Against Women Act. Now, it doesn't mean that others are not assisted through that, but that overall it's really important to name the problem as primarily a problem that women suffer.
Tom, is that what you saw, particularly in your work down in Brooklyn? Was it predominantly female victims?
It was predominantly female victims, but there are a number of studies out there that say that the statistics we have at the moment aren't really accurate, because men that are abused are much less likely to report. I mean, there is an issue with women being very reluctant to report and very reluctant to follow through. But I think it's even a bigger problem for any men that are abused, especially in the case of gay men. They really don't want to report it to the police. In some cases, they may not be out to their own families, and really the last thing they want to do is to draw more attention to themselves. So they tend to, you know, just put up with it and not report it.
That's interesting.
Barb, can I also mention there's a program in Albany called In Our Own Voices that serves this region, which has a domestic violence, anti-violence project specifically for LGBT communities, so lesbian, gay, transgender, and gay communities. So it's important to know that there are resources for people who may be particularly reluctant to reach out to the criminal justice or legal system.
I see. Well, at least we were talking earlier about how the definition of who is covered by the domestic violence statutes has expanded. Mm-hmm. Explain to our listeners who can be subject to a court proceeding for domestic violence.
Well, it used to be, in order to go to family court for a civil proceeding, you had to be related by blood or marriage or have a child in common with your abuser. This past legislative session, that's changed. So now if someone is living with their abuser and not married, or is a boyfriend or girlfriend of an abusive partner, but have an intimate relationship, an established relationship of some sort, they can be same-gender partners. They can be teenage boyfriend, girlfriend. That those people actually can now go to family court. It's really up to the family court to determine whether or not you can access the services, but you can certainly go and try to get a violation of an order of protection or deal with different legal issues through the family court now in an expanded way. That also subjects those people to mandatory arrest, because that's also captured under that same statute. So it really does expand the ability for victims to get protection, both from law enforcement and through the civil justice system. It used to be you had to go to the criminal court system, and a lot of people, as Tom said, especially a gay and lesbian partner, they're not going to want to necessarily always call the police. Now they can go to family court and ask for protection through that without having to necessarily involve the police.
Because the records are not necessarily open like they would be in a criminal case.
Right, and it's you have a lower standard of proof. You don't have to go beyond a reasonable doubt. In civil court, it's really preponderance preponderance of evidence, which is 51% of the evidence. So you're much more likely to get help, especially earlier on, which is one of the reasons that people push this bill, is rather than have to wait till things got so bad that the police had to come and make an arrest and there was, you know, some injury, you're able to go more proactively to family court and get a civil order for protection.
All right, let's shift now to away from the victims to the abusers. Tom, in your experience, both in prosecuting and now in defending, who are some of the abusers?
Well, I think the stereotypical image that people have when they hear of a domestic violence abuser is the guy you see on Cops in the white...
No shirt.
Exactly. No shirt, being chased by the cops, you know, maybe living on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. But really, the abusers that I have come across have run the gamut, from doctors, lawyers, in some cases judges, professionals, young, old. There is no specific group that you would say is typical. An abuser can be from any class, any socioeconomic group.
To what extent have you seen alcohol involved in domestic violence incidents? I'd like actually both of you to comment on that.
But usually, by the time we got involved in the DA's office, it was as a result of an alcohol-fueled incident. But, you know, there was a pattern going on there before the one alcohol-fueled incident. It's just that the alcohol raised it to the level of abuse such that the police were called.
Yeah, and Lisa, drugs or alcohol, how much do you see that involved in abusive incidents?
Well, we know that it's certainly correlated with a number of domestic violence incidents, but it's not a causative factor. A lot of times people think that it's the drinking that causes the abuse, and that's not the case. Oftentimes an abuser will use drugs or alcohol as part of their pattern of abuse as a way to excuse the abuse, and it also makes the victim of domestic violence think that it's because of the alcohol primarily, but really if you look at it, most of the time you're going to have abusive incidents whether or not the person's been drinking. And again, we have to look beyond just the physical to look at all the other forms of control in that family that goes on whether or not they're drinking or using drugs.
So you wouldn't necessarily see domestic violence as an isolated incident. You would see it as a culmination of a pattern of conduct?
Right. It's a pattern of behavior. So even though you might have a victim say, well, it's the only time he hit me, if you talk to her about what else is going on in her relationship, there's other kinds of control. She's afraid. She's walking on eggshells. Everything is revolving around that batterer in the house. Mm-hmm. So she might not identify it as such, but she's being controlled and victimized.
All right. In the few minutes we have left before the break, Lisa, what you were just talking about sort of leads directly into the question I think is on many people's minds, and that is, why does the victim stay?
Well, that's probably the biggest question. You're only leaving me a couple of seconds to talk about this, but mostly because, well, there's a variety of things, but it's hard for anybody to end a relationship with somebody that they've cared about when you think about it, whether or not there's abuse. So when you add abuse and control and fear on top of it, it makes it very, very hard. So someone who is... has children with someone or has lived with somebody, has financial entanglements with whether they're boyfriend or a husband, it's very hard to get out of that. You also want to think that they can change. And they often will say that they will change, that they're sorry for what happened. And a victim will want to believe that. Or they are being told, if you call the police or if you leave me, I'm going to kill you. And we know that the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence is when they try to leave.
And the victim themselves, as I understand it, will also often make excuses for the abuser. What kind of excuses do you hear?
Well, oftentimes they've been told that by the abuser and everyone around them, that, well, he just lost his temper, or I did something to make him angry, or he's been drinking, or he's under a lot of stress at work. And we know that none of those things cause domestic violence. And it's not about the behavior of the victim. Victims will do everything they can to try to juggle everything to make everything right, and it doesn't matter. If they're living with somebody who's abusive, they're going to find a reason in their own mind to abuse and control them.
Have you seen many financially independent women with no children who still stay in these relationships?
Absolutely. What we know is it takes between 5 and 7 times for a victim of domestic violence to finally get out. It doesn't mean they don't want to, but it takes planning. It takes safety planning. It takes support. It takes options that often we don't have for many women.
Thank you. Well, we'd love to hear what you have to say. Give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. Time now for the news and weather. When we're back, we'll look at what happens once a domestic violence case is taken into the courtroom.
Fox News Radio, I'm Chris Foster. He campaigned on a platform of change. Now President-elect Barack Obama could bring it by way of executive order.
Whether that's on energy transformation, on improving health care, on stem cell research, there's a lot that the president can do using his executive authority without waiting for congressional action, and I think we'll see the president do that.
John Podesta with the Obama transition team. The search for survivors continues in Haiti after a school collapsed there on Friday.
Haitian officials say they will begin using heavier equipment to clear the debris and level what remains of the school just outside Port-au-Prince, the country's capital. Rescuers did manage to extract four children from the rubble. Haitian authorities, meanwhile, have arrested the owner of the school.
Fox News Radio's Carmen Gentile. And Jimmy Johnson takes the checkered flag in Arizona. He needs to finish 35th or better next week to win his third straight NASCAR championship. Fox News, we report, you decide.
10 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
Some showers possible overnight as lows drop into the upper 30s and those sticking around early in the day on Monday. We're not talking a complete and total washout, but we do want you to be aware. Later on, we got a mix of sun and clouds, your temperatures reaching into the mid-40s, and Veterans Day looking nice. Partly cloudy, your highs mid-40s once again. Showers possible at the end of the week. From the Weather Channel, I'm Danielle Banks with the 810 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
Pets aren't just animals. They're companions and often members of the family. Unfortunately, pets are not always treated with the care they deserve. Animal cruelty and neglect are sadly a reality. Detecting and reporting abuse are the most important steps in bringing animal cruelty to an end. The Schenectady County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, SPCA, is a nonprofit volunteer organization that investigates complaints of animal cruelty. Our volunteers donate their time and energy because they believe in our mission to protect animals. We are not funded. We rely exclusively on public donations. You can help with a tax-deductible donation by calling 518-755-9517 or visit our website, SchenectadySPCA.org. Or if you'd like to join the Schenectady SPCA as a volunteer, again the number 518-755-9517 or on the web, SchenectadySPCA.org.
If a commercial lease is in your future, listen closely. Conley Associates will provide you with an honest, unbiased comparison of available office space. Unlike the competition, Conley Associates works directly with you, the tenant, finding your business the ideal location at the best terms. Best of all, leave the landlords to us, because we represent tenants only. Secure your new office space with a tenants-only approach from Conley Associates. Landlords need not apply. Conley Associates, 463-5500.
Well, thank you for coming back to us. If you're a first-time listener, you're listening to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King, in for our usual host, Greg Rinke. Our show comes to you each Sunday at 9 p.m. when attorneys from the law firm of Tully Rinke give insights into the legal issues that matter most to you. Tonight, we're talking about domestic violence, and we're broadcasting around the planet on WGY.com. Joining me tonight is criminal defense attorney Tom Carr and executive director of the legal project, Lisa Frisch. I'm told the Giants game is on tonight, but if you have time, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. When we left off, we had just finished talking about definitions of domestic violence and some common misconceptions and perceptions. I want to turn now to talking about the actual process itself. If someone is a victim of domestic violence, Lisa, what's the first thing they should do? Where do they go?
Well, it depends on what the incident is that the victim might be trying to respond to. But overall, what we say is a victim should really reach out to their local domestic violence program, and they can find that through the statewide or national hotline. And I can give that number if you like.
Go ahead.
Which is the state hotline is 1-800-942-6906. And the national hotline, if you're not in New York State, it's 1-800-799-SAFE or 799-7233. And also, you can look it up online or in your phone book in terms of your local program. Reach out to some support. if you're dealing with an incident where you're at risk, of course you should call the police if you feel comfortable doing that. The laws have changed over the years, which now require police to take domestic violence very seriously, to arrest in many cases where they have probable cause that a crime was committed. So certainly a criminal justice response is appropriate in many cases. For those victims who may want a civil order of protection, they can go to family court, again, if they have an intimate relationship with that abuser, and ask for protection through civil court without necessarily having to involve the police. You can also go to both criminal and civil court at the same time. If you're filing for a divorce, for example, you can also get an order of protection through Supreme Court. So all three courts can provide a victim with orders of protection. But getting that support from a local domestic violence program is really, really important because you need support through that process and you need to have some assistance in terms of developing a safety plan and identifying your options.
All right, and now let's look at it from the other angle. Tom, as someone who now defends people in the criminal system, somebody comes to you, they were just served with an order of protection, there's criminal charges pending. What does the accused do?
Well, the first thing is to read carefully the order of protection and find out what kind of an order of protection it is.
What kinds are there?
Basically, there are two kinds. There is a full stay-away, no-contact order of protection. What that means is if you're the defendant named, you have to stay away from the person whose name is contained in the body of the order of protection. You have to stay away from their home, their place of business, their school, their church, etc. And you also have to have no contact whatsoever. Now, no contact, as many judges will tell you, no contact means no contact whatsoever. You can't show up on their doorstep. You can't call them. You can't text message them. You can't send them a letter. And you can't have somebody else contact them on your behalf.
What if the individual calls the accused, the person that got the order of protection, calls them up? I hear this all the time. Oh, she called me or he called me. That was okay, wasn't it?
That is something that, unfortunately, I hear all the time. And usually what that winds up with is a violation of the order of protection, which is another criminal charge in and of itself. And if it's done often enough, then the violating an order of protection can actually rise to a felony level. So what I tell my clients is, I don't care if the person calls you. I don't care if she calls you and says, you know, the plumbing is broken, the water is flooding out of the washing machine or something, hang up. You can't get involved, you can't answer, you can't go over there.
Now, and the other kind of the order of protection is what you referred to as a refrain from?
It's a refrain from. It's also sometimes called a no illegal contact order of protection.
And how does that differ?
That differs in that you can still be around the person, you can talk to them, you just can't do anything that constitutes illegal conduct. You can't hit them, you can't harass them, you can't abuse them.
Now, which you weren't supposed to do in the first place.
Exactly, and that's what a lot of people say to me. But the reason, or one of the reasons for giving that kind of an order of protection is, again, if you violate that order of protection, not only do you have the new criminal charges for harassment or for assault or whatever, but you have the additional charge of violating the order of protection in and of itself.
And possible mandatory arrest as well.
Absolutely.
Now, I have people who come to me who have orders of protections issued against them, and perhaps I'm handling their divorce. Not only do they have to stay away from their spouse, they can't go near their children either. How do the criminal courts handle that, or is that, in your experience, simply a case for family or Supreme Court?
Well, the criminal courts, in a sense, pass the buck to the family court, because what they will normally do in situations like that is the criminal court will issue an order of protection, but they will include at the bottom, subject to family court order. So whatever the family court judge deems as appropriate, then the criminal court order will track along with that. And that, I think, recognizes the more resources that family court has in terms of law guardians, et cetera.
And this is where, as I understand it, the integrated court system comes into play when somebody has perhaps a divorce case going or a family court case going and a criminal order protection. Tell our listeners a little bit about this integrated court system.
The integrated court system is sometimes called the IDV courts. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. And basically, the model is one family, one judge. So instead of, let's say, a family are going through a custody issue and there's a domestic violence issue. In the past, the domestic violence, the criminal issue would have gone to criminal court. The custody would have gone to family court. So you have people with different lawyers in front of different judges. And sometimes you'd get orders from the judges that wouldn't exactly gel with each other. The idea of the IDV court is the one judge hears everything. The one judge would hear the domestic violence, the criminal part, and would hear the custody or whatever other family issues there may be.
So there's continuity for the family.
There's continuity for the family. Now, there are not IDV courts in every county. Actually, there is not one in Albany County, although there is in the surrounding counties. Rensselaer County has one, Schenectady has one, Fulton, Montgomery have one.
Now, these orders of protection can also include a clause requiring what's called a surrender of firearms. What is that?
Yeah, that is something that's increasingly mandated now, is that if the defendant named in the order of protection has any firearms, usually it's hunting rifles or shotguns or something like that, they must surrender those to the police. Now, you're not giving them up forever. The police have to take them in, give you a receipt for them, and they keep them in safekeeping until they get an order from the judge saying the case is over and it's okay to give them back.
And if an order of protection is issued on a longer-term basis, do they continue to hold those firearms as long as the order of protection is in effect?
Yes, they do.
All right. I'd like both of you to comment on a phenomenon we were discussing earlier, and that is what we call the recanting witness, somebody who makes a complaint, criminal court, family court, for an order of protection, pleads specific instances of abuse of some kind, but when push comes to shove and the case gets ready to be heard, suddenly they're not so willing to step up and say what they said when they made the charges. Lisa, first, your experience with that.
Well, it's totally is conforming with the dynamics of domestic violence because you have victims of abuse who are afraid, who are being controlled, who have been berated and put down and treated poorly and have very little support system, all of a sudden thrust into a justice system where they need to be the witness against the person who's been controlling and threatening them. So it's extremely terrifying for many victims. And many abusers will say, if you testify against me, if you file charges, if you call the police, I'm going to kill you. Or I'm going to take the kids, or you're never going to see your family again, all of those things. So the number one reason that victims recant is they're being coerced to do so. For some victims, they realize that, oh, my God, if he goes to jail, it's the only money we have coming in. He's going to lose his job. The reality of it hits home. So it can be very, it can be very pragmatic for many victims when they realize what's at stake if they go through the system. They also may believe that he may change, and he's begging her to drop the charges. He may be using oftentimes batterers will have more resources than the victim, so they may say, listen, I'll barter custody arrangements if you drop the charges. So all of these things go on. It's part of the control and the coercion that goes on as abuse. It doesn't stop just because somebody's reaching out for help with the justice system or an arrest was made. You still have those attempts at coercion, whether directly or indirectly. It can be family members. That's why third-party contact is so important with orders of protection. But victims will get a lot of that from their own family. You know, keeping the family together is so important in many cultures and in this world that it's very difficult if a victim thinks, oh, my God, it's because of me our family is going to disintegrate. Mm-hmm. It's a very frightening prospect.
Tom, what's your take on that, Ben?
Well, it's from a practitioner's point of view, it's very frustrating because we often get the situation when I was in the DA's office that you'd have a woman call up, make a report of domestic violence, the police are called, and then as the case goes on longer and longer, her support of that case becomes less and less. And obviously, the reasons that Lisa brings up are very valid, but they're unfortunately never communicated to the ADA. So you wind up, as I had to do in Brooklyn, was sometimes go to trial where the victim comes in and testifies not on her own behalf, but on behalf of the defendant.
The person that they accused.
Exactly.
And what about, I'd imagine it's almost like the boy who cries wolf, someone who recants and then a week later, a month later, files a new complaint. From a prosecution standpoint, how would you deal with that?
Well, from a prosecution standpoint, we realize the issues that Lisa already highlighted. So, you still take these complaints seriously. The ones that are a little more incredible sometimes are the ones where as soon as the police show up or even on the phone when the woman calls the police, she's like, well, I don't want to arrest him. I just want you to talk to him. And I think that some people seem to be of the idea that the police are actually counselors. They're not. There is mandatory arrest if they suspect that there is some kind of a criminal activity. So we've often had situations where it was verbal arguments between a couple that escalated to such a level that one of them called the police, and it's like, well, wait a minute, I don't want anybody arrested. But unfortunately, if the police come out, Sometimes they feel to cover themselves, they have to make an arrest.
Even if the complainant doesn't want the person arrested.
Exactly.
In fact, the law requires that the police assess that case independently and not put the burden on the victim to say, I want him arrested.
Treat it as an independent crime.
Right. Look at the probable cause of the scene, the evidence at the scene to make that decision, not base it all on the victim because understanding of what pressure she may be under and safety risks if she's the one to say, I want him arrested or if she's the one testifying against him.
Okay.
So victims who testify for the abuser are usually doing it to protect themselves.
All right. Well, it's time for a short break. And when we're back, we'll look at the resources available for domestic violence victims. Feel free to give us a call with any of your questions. To reach us, call 1-800-TALK-WGY or press *WGY on your cell phone. And if you don't have a chance to get in touch with us tonight, you can reach us at the Tully Rinke office all week at 518-218-7100.
You know this isn't the right job for you, but the problem is you don't know what the right job is. If you're looking for career advice, Careers in Transition LLC can help. Careers in Transition LLC is a career counseling firm that helps you figure out the right job for you. They're not an employment agency, and Dr. Tom Denham is not a headhunter, but they can help you write a better resume, prep for a job interview, and a lot more. Careers in Transition LLC, 11 Computer Drive West in Albany, 366-8451, and online, careersintransitionllc.com.
You've worked hard to acquire your wealth. Let us help you keep it. Hi, I'm Abigail Doolittle, Portfolio Manager at Johnson Illington Advisors. Johnson Illington is a money management firm that provides very conservative and disciplined portfolio management services. Our main goal at Johnson Illington is to preserve and enhance your wealth. We have a highly experienced team led by nationally known investment veteran and economist Hugh Johnson. Visit our website at johnson-illington.com. Johnson Illington Advisors on Broadway in Albany.
All right, Integral One Network Solutions. Tell me what they do again.
Well, they worked with us to design our new computer network. That's really made a difference. Helps us run our business better. They monitor everything 24/7 to keep it running smoothly. And they manage it all, so I don't have to hire an IT guy.
So when I hire Integral One, they manage my network so I can manage my business. Talk about peace of mind.
Integral One Network Solutions. Online at integral1.net. That's integral1.net. 464-4014.
Usually, a mortgage company's sole focus is property. But First Rate Funding is centered on people, not property. Whether you're buying a home or struggling with your current adjustable rate mortgage, First Rate Funding will give you the same amazing personal service. First Rate Funding, New Carter Road, Albany, and Broadway, Saratoga Springs. Don't wait. Call today, 452-4700, and please go online, firstratefunding.net, and see how they can help you today. Registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department. Mortgage loans arranged with third-party providers.
Well, we're back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, and I'm Barbara King. Hosting with me tonight is Tully Rinke criminal defense attorney Tom Carr, and tonight's guest is executive director of the Legal Project, Lisa Frisch. Find out more about the show at WGY.com or visit TullyLegal.com to see what else we can do for your legal needs. We've still got a little time left to answer your questions on domestic violence, so if you have any, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. As we come back, I want to look at the other side of the domestic violence issue and talk to Lisa and Tom a little bit about the abuser or the accused abuser. We've talked about resources that are available for victims of domestic violence. What, if any, resources are out there for somebody accused?
Well, one of the things that most accused, especially on a felony level of domestic violence, are pretty much going to be required to do is to go into what's called a batterer's intervention program. And that is, as I said, pretty much mandated on the felony cases. So there are programs out there for defendants who are charged with domestic violence.
And we're going to get into talking a bit more about resources, but I don't want to skip over an important issue, and that's one that I see a lot in divorce cases, the effect of domestic violence on a couple who are disputing custody. Lisa, talk a little bit about that. There is now some mandatory language in our statutes about the considerations.
Right. And judges are required essentially to consider domestic violence as a factor when determining custody. So it is an important issue within the family court and in Supreme Court when divorces are and custodial arrangements are being determined. Interestingly, we find that for most of our clients, it's not like they don't want their husbands or ex-husbands to see their children. It's really about safety issues. And there are some cases where the batterer is so violent and there's been threats against the children that there are exceptions. But most of the time, they don't want to deprive their father of contact with the kids. I think a lot of people assume otherwise, but that's generally the case. But we do have lots of issues with custody and also with violence that happens during visitation arrangements and custodial exchanges that we have to be very cautious about.
Well, a resource that I've perceived to be very necessary and very lacking is a resource of supervised visitation. When somebody is accused of domestic violence, if it is so extreme, courts will sometimes say, you can only have contact with your child while supervised by someone else. And that's very difficult for parents. It's very painful. It's not the best thing for children. I have found very few organizations out there that will offer supervised visitation, and if they do, they charge, and not everyone has the resources to pay for it. What are you aware of that's out there for people facing that situation?
Well, there are several, but there are not a lot of them available, and people can give our office a call, and we can give them the information about what is an option for them. And they can call us at 518-435-1770. We can talk about lots of options that people can have. But oftentimes the courts will use family members as the supervisor. It's not necessarily a good thing. Mm-hmm. We've had it where the victim was the supervisor ordered by the court. Now, obviously, that's not a good choice. So we do have those programs. They're usually only going to be for those extreme cases and usually for the short term. But I think it would be great to have additional resources in the Capital Region to make it more available because it's very, very critical.
I agree. And Tom, as your role as a defense attorney, and it's interesting talking to you because you've prosecuted and now defended, have you seen either in either role as prosecutor or a defender accused individuals saying to you, well, this incident didn't happen, or if it did, it was exaggerated. It's really because we're fighting over custody.
Yeah, I've seen from both sides many different reasons given for conduct alleged. One of the things that we frequently saw was where a victim would get an order of protection, and then all of a sudden the defendant would be rearrested on a violation of the order of protection. And there's a phrase that the judges like to use, which is that the order of protection is a shield, not a sword.
Meaning exactly what?
Meaning that the order of protection is there to protect the individual. It's not to be used as a means to go out and get, for want of a better word, the defendant. And that ties into something that you touched on earlier, Barb, which is the victim gets an order of protection and then calls the defendant and has him over to the house. You know, oh, I'm sorry, why don't you come over for dinner? There, an argument ensues. She picks up the phone, calls the police, and says, he's over here and I have an order of protection. That is, in a sense, using the order of protection as a sword. Now, on the flip side of that, I also used to tell any victims that I had to deal with that an order of protection is great, but you know, it's made of paper. It's not made of Kevlar. And when it comes down to it, right, the order of protection in and of itself is not going to stop the defendant doing something if he's in a situation right there and then where he can do something or where he's about to do something.
I found people on the receiving end of an order of protection and accused often doesn't really understand. Lisa said before, the person filing the charges often doesn't understand the terms of the order of protection, but the accused doesn't either. And I hear these things, well, you know, we were both shopping at Price Chopper, so we stopped and talked. My advice is, if you see the other person at Price Chopper, I don't care if you're at the checkout line, leave the groceries and walk out. Have you had any other instances where people have violated these orders, perhaps innocently, say emailing somebody or you even said earlier text messaging? I mean, how harmful could that be?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a case in Brooklyn once where the victim alleged violating of the order of protection because the defendant sent her a birthday card. And there was nothing, you know, threatening or anything in the birthday card. It was just like, hey, you know, happy birthday. There was nothing really more to it than that. But that simple act, He had contacted her through the mail, which was a violation of the order of protection.
And we're on radio, so you can't see Lisa's expression, but she made an interesting face when you said that, because I know what she's thinking. She's thinking that in some instances is another form of control. Talk about
Absolutely
what's on your mind.
I mean, you've got an abuser who's trying to often get her back, get her to drop the charges. So sending notes or birthday cards or flowers or things that otherwise would seem very innocent are really part of that pattern of control. So it's very important that judges make it clear when they issue orders that there should be no contact whatsoever, no matter how innocent it would seem.
Lisa, when we were talking earlier, you brought up what I thought was a unique perspective that the law has on abuse and orders of protection. You mentioned some new legislation regarding pets.
Right.
What is that about?
Yes. Again, this legislative session, there's a new law put in place that now pets can be included in orders of protection. And that's in recognition that the majority of women who have pets who enter shelters said that there had been threats or injury or even killing of their pets. And oftentimes it's a reason why victims will not leave, because they're afraid to leave their pets. So it's a very real part of that coercive control.
A lot of safe homes won't take dogs and cats.
No, they often can't take them themselves. But
right
now a lot of programs like Unity House now has an arrangement with the Humane Society. So in a case like where a battered woman can't take her pet to the shelter, the Humane Society can take and shelter that pet at the same time. That's extremely helpful for a victim who has been really afraid to leave their dog or cat or companion animal in the house.
Well, it seems the laws are getting more sensitive to these issues, which leads me into my next topic. You actually just this weekend were doing some training of judges around the issues of domestic violence. And there is a perception out there that, well, you know, maybe the police don't really understand these issues, and to some extent maybe the judges don't. How sensitive is the bench to the issues of domestic violence in your experience?
Well, I think overall the justice system has become much more sensitive to this issue, and I know the Office of Court Administration puts in place a variety of different training programs for judges. There's been training for law enforcement, other criminal justice officials, but these were town and village judges that I was training in the 3rd Judicial District, which is generally Albany and South.
And they're often the front line of these criminal charges.
Yes, they're the ones that do the arraignments at 3 o'clock in the morning. They're the ones who issue the original orders of protection. They're the ones who can take the guns right away. So they need to get as much information as possible, because what they do or don't do and the demeanor that they have in the courtroom and the information they provide to both the victim, and if the victim is there, or the perpetrator, in terms of what's an order of protection, what is covered, what are they required to not do, that can make or break whether or not somebody is going to follow that order of protection. So their role is really critical.
In the minute and a half or so we have left, we were talking briefly earlier about new issues of technology safety. Now that people have computers and GPS systems, what are some of the things you're seeing in the field of domestic violence, and how do these play into that?
It's interesting, because I've been doing this work since the 1980s, when, you know, you just wouldn't even think about global tracking devices and things like that. But now there are so many ways to track a person, whether it's through their cell phone, whether it's putting a GPS device on their car without their knowledge, whether it's putting spyware on their computer and being able to track all the keystrokes, or as simple as just looking to see what websites people have gone to.
All forms of stalking, is that the idea?
Right. Well, it's stalking, and it's certainly a lot of control. So whether or not the abuser is living with the victim or not, they have ways in which to stalk and to track them. It's important that victims of domestic violence know that, and there are things that they can do to help keep safe, and use the library computer, use a friend's computer. Be careful about what you're looking at home, where somebody would be able to track that device. We even had a case where a victim was sure that he was recording her at home, and she couldn't figure out how, and when she had some construction done, a recording device fell out of the wall. So a lot of times, you know, people will say, oh, come on, you know, you're being paranoid, but honestly, it does happen.
Well, in the moment we have left, would you please, again, give our listeners your website and phone number?
Our website is www.legalproject.org, and our number is 518-435 1770, and please get in touch with us and we can give you even more information about what we do.
Well, that's it for us this Sunday, and I'd like to give special thanks to both Tom and Lisa for joining me tonight. And if you didn't have a chance to reach us this evening, you can be found next week at Tully Rinke's offices at 218-7100, and Greg will be back for our next show.